So like I said last night, the main sermon this weekend is three parts, one last night, one tonight, one tomorrow morning. So this morning, this Saturday morning session is not part of that main thread. It's a separate standalone thing, but it's related. And what I want to talk to you about this morning is something that's a little bit more immediately applicable. It's a little bit more practical. It's also something that if you've been around LMCC for any length of time, you've heard me talk about plenty of times before, but we're going to look at it from a different angle this morning. I want to talk to you about the importance of solitude. So how is this related to what we were talking about last night, about coming to experience God, meet God for the first time, God becoming real to you, coming to see his beauty, coming to understand his glory? It's related in that for most people, the first time that happens for them, and the majority of the times that that happens for them, it happens when they're alone. This is true in Scripture. It's true throughout church history. It's true even just anecdotally today. When people have this moment of actually meeting God and seeing his beauty, it happens when they're off by themselves, which, if you think about it, just makes sense logically, because nothing reinforces the phenomenon of God as a concept, nothing reinforces that more than constantly talking about him and never talking to him. Because that's what you do with a concept. You discuss it. You talk about it. You listen to somebody else talk about it. You think about it. You read about it. You debate about it. And if that's all you do with God, then of course God is a concept. You're treating him like a concept. For him to become real to you, you have to treat him like a real person. A real person standing there, you don't talk about them like they're not even there. You talk to them. You engage with them. And that's when God starts to become real. So as Matt said, we're going to do that in right after this. Right after we finish talking about the importance of it, we're going to do it. And we've done this every year at the retreat. If thinking back to 5 years ago, one of my main motivations for doing this retreat, period, the reason I wanted to do it, was I thought the whole thing would be worthwhile if I could just accomplish this one goal, which is seemingly impossible, and that's to make a group of New Yorkers sit still for a full hour. Psalm 46:10 says, "Be still and know that I am God." If you're going to know that he's God, if you're going to experience him as God, you have to be still. But instead, we're the exact opposite of that. You know, we cannot stop moving. And we think it's normal because everybody else around us is in the same boat. I did this study with mice, love studies with mice, where they gave them amphetamines, and what they discovered is that you don't have to give a mouse a whole lot, and the mouse will eventually kill itself because it gets so hopped up, so excited, so running itself around that it just runs itself to death. Now, what's even more interesting for our context is that the lethal dosage they found was 20 times smaller for mice that were in a group versus a mouse that was alone, because they got them each other so hopped up and so excited. And if they put a mouse that wasn't on anything in a group of mice that had been given the drug, even the mouse that wasn't on anything would still be dead in 10 minutes, just trying to keep up with all the other mice. So does that sound familiar to anybody? That's you. That's you. You can't stop. And you're so worked up. You don't even realize you're so worked up because everybody around you is so worked up. And so it doesn't seem like that big a deal. But it is a big deal because your soul is dying because you are refusing to give it the one thing that it really needs. We've talked before on Sunday mornings about this story in the Gospels of Mary and Martha, these two sisters, and their Jesus is coming over for dinner, so they're making preparations, and they're running behind. They're running behind in their preparations. So Jesus gets there, and stuff isn't finished. So Mary goes out and says, well, I guess that's that, and she goes out to be with Jesus. And Martha stays back in the kitchen trying to finish up the meal, getting all the while more bitter and angry with Mary for deserting her, leaving her to do the work. And what's interesting about this for us is that we have a church that's almost entirely made up of Marthas. You know, this is the basic DNA, basic personality of the vast majority of the people in our church. So eventually, Martha, you know, she can't take anymore. She comes out and she explodes, you know, probably in tears, says, "Jesus, you know, she left me to do all the work by myself. Tell her to come help me." And Jesus says, "Martha, Martha, you are worried about so many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better." And commentators have pointed out that when Jesus says only one thing is needed, as someone who is steeped in the Psalms, he had to be thinking there of Psalm 27, verse 4, where David says, "Only one thing do I seek, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord." This is what we were talking about last night, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord. And David said, only one thing do I seek, one thing only do I need, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord. I want what Isaiah got in the temple. I want what the angels get every day. I want what I've gotten to taste before, but I want more of it. I want it again. I want to gaze on God's beauty. This one thing do I seek. Now, my experience has been that when people hear verses like this, when David says, "This one thing do I seek, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord," or when Jesus says, "Only one thing is necessary," or even last Sunday, you know, when Paul is talking about this one thing I do, you know, he's talking about everything else is garbage to me compared to knowing Christ. That's the only thing I need. My experience has been, when people hear these types of verses, they tend to have a very negative reaction to them because they feel hyperbolic. They feel unrealistic. You know, they feel like, well, how can anyone do that? This one thing. And they feel like it's like overstating the case to say this one thing. You know, the phrase that I've heard more times than I can count in response to these verses is people saying, "Well, you know, it's not like you can just sit around and read the Bible all day. You know, I mean, you can't just sit and pray all day. I mean, society would break down. You have to put food on the table, and there's stuff that has to be done just in life. So what do you mean, want this one thing? I mean, it's great for David and Paul and Jesus to be able to go and just this one thing, just gaze on the beauty of the Lord, and that's all they do. It's great for Mary to be able to gaze on Jesus and sit at his feet. But you still have to eat. And so Martha has to make the food. You know, somebody has to make the food. So it's just not realistic. Maybe for some people, that's their special calling. But for most of us, it just isn't a model for most of us. What that objection misses is that Jesus was by far the busiest man of his generation. You know, Gospel of Mark says they often didn't have time for meals. It was so busy. The schedule was so packed. David was not a monk. He was a general and a king. And before that, he was an outlaw who was constantly running for his life. Or Paul probably traveled more miles in a shorter span of time than any human being had ever done up to that point in history. You know, it's like how business guys today, you know, complain/brag about how many miles they log in a year, and you know elite status they have with the airline. Paul would have wiped the floor with all of you. I mean, he was the ultimate road warrior. So we're not talking about monasticism here. We're not talking about not doing anything else. What we're talking about is knowing when and how to go, and knowing when and how to stop and close the computer and turn off the phone, and turn off the TV, and just be still before God. And these guys knew how to do it. These guys knew how to do it, and it wasn't the enemy of them accomplishing things. It was actually the secret to why they accomplished so much. You know, you have these two choices. You have the average New Yorker who will never stop, and because they, you know, they don't want to be looked at as lazy, and they do want to brag about how many hours they work, and so it's just constantly going But what do they really have to show for it? You know, besides climbing the ladder, what do they really have to show for it? Besides more money, what do they really have to show for it? Versus these guys who had the courage to sit still, even though everybody was laughing at them and saying, why are you wasting all that time? And then they rise up from that stillness and take bold, decisive action that actually has an impact. And you see this in the life of Christ. You see with Jesus both of these things. First, that it's through this time alone with God, through this stillness, that he gets the direction for his life and knows the right thing to do. And second, that he not only knows the right thing to do, but he actually has the strength to do it. There's a big difference between activity and productivity. Activity is when you just do something. Productivity is when you do the right thing at the right time in the right way. And the trick about productivity is doing the right thing at the right time in the right way is almost always the hardest thing to do in that particular moment. It's the thing you least want to do. So what people do is they stay active, they stay busy, and distract themselves from the thing they should be doing, the thing that the highest leverage activity. And what they need is wisdom and strength to find that one thing that would make all the difference. You know, one good idea, one paradigm shift can be worth more than thousands of hours of grinding it out. But you have to actually have the space to get it. So there's this episode in the Gospels where Jesus, it's really kind of like his breakout performance. It's kind of his coming out. It's the first big thing that happens in his career. This one Saturday in Capernaum. So up to this point, you know, he obviously raised in Nazareth. And then as an adult, when he starts his ministry, his first gig is as a country preacher in this town of Capernaum, very close to Nazareth. So he moves from Nazareth to Capernaum, and he just preaches in the synagogue every Saturday. And everything's normal until this particular Saturday, when in the middle of his sermon, this guy stands up in the middle of the congregation and starts shouting, go away, Jesus of Nazareth. We know who you are, the Holy One of God. And so, you know, everybody's looking at him to see how he's going to respond. One of the great tests of a public speaker is how they respond to hecklers. And, you know, if it had been me, I probably would have gotten really flustered and just sat down, you know, quit. And if some of you want to test me right now by heckling me, please, please don't do that. Just be awkward. So everybody's looking at Jesus to see how he's going to respond. And Jesus, he doesn't even talk to the guy. He just talks directly to the demon inside the guy, and he says, be quiet and come out. And the demon shrieks, throws the guy onto the floor, convulsing, and comes out of the guy without hurting him any further. And the text says, amazement gripped the audience. So, you know, now the secret's out. Who is this guy? So then he goes later that same day, that afternoon, to Peter's mother-in-law's house, and he heals her. She's sick. And people hear about that. And by sunset that day, the entire town of Capernaum has gathered around at the doorstep, at the front porch of Peter's mother-in-law's house, where he's still hanging out. And they just come one at a time, and he heals one at a time. And, you know, the whole town is there and sees it. Now, the reason I tell you all that is because of what happens next. Because what happens next is it says, very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up and went to a solitary place to pray. So, you know, everybody else wakes up, and they're all looking for him. And the crowds are looking for him. His disciples are looking for him. The disciples get to him first, and they say, Jesus, where you been? Come on, we got to get started. Everybody's looking for you. We got to do it again. You know, there's more people that are sick. There's more people that need to be healed. Let's go, round two. And Jesus says, no, we're going to go on to the next town. They say, what? You're crazy. You know, yesterday was it. You just went from being a nobody to being a somebody overnight. And everybody wants to be healed. We've got momentum. We've got the big mo. We've got to just stay here and keep rolling. This is going to be amazing. Today's going to be even better than yesterday. And he says, no, we're going on to the next town. He would have never known to do that. He would have never had the wisdom to make that move unless he had extricated himself from this rushing river of events. Because the default move was to stay in Capernaum. That's what made the most sense. Again, that day, nothing had ever happened like that in that town. Nothing like that had ever happened in Jesus' ministry. It was obvious. We just do it again. You know, everybody's here. This is amazing. We just do it again. It was the obvious choice. And yet Jesus says, no, we're going to do something else. And he only has that ability because he spent time alone with God. He has this wisdom to make the hard right turn just when he needs to make it. But he would have never had that wisdom without the time alone with God. It's not just the wisdom. It's also the strength. It's also the strength and the energy to carry out whatever this action is. I'm guessing for most of you, you don't feel like energy is a problem for you. You think you have plenty of energy. And what I would say is, well, you do have plenty of energy to stay active. But it's one thing to have enough energy to go from meeting to meeting and errand to errand and email to email. That's one level of energy, and that's how much energy you have. So you think you have enough. It's another type of energy. It's another level of energy to have enough energy to do the right thing. Just try. Just try for a week to, in any given moment, no distractions, no reaching out to this urgent problem here or there, just for a week, always one thing at a time, do the most high leverage activity you can, one after another. And what you find is that you just don't have the strength. You don't have enough energy to do it. So where do you get it? You get it from the same place that you get the direction. Isaiah 40, very famous passage, says, even youths grow tired and weary, even young men stumble and fall, but those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall rise up on wings like eagles. They shall run and not grow weary. They shall walk and not faint. He gives you the energy. He not only tells you what to do, but he gives you the strength to do it. You see this with Jesus. He's very aware, because he's a human being, because of his limitations, he's very aware of his fuel gauge at any particular point. So if he does a lot of draining things consecutively, if he's teaching all day out by the lake and he's healing people and he's talking with the disciples, after a while, he's watching it go down, and he gets to this point of desperation where he says, I gotta get away. I gotta get out to the wilderness by myself. And then, he has no food or anything, and then all of a sudden he comes back and he's like totally fine. Which is, it's a little weird, It's like, well, what is he doing when he's out by himself? Is he giving him injections of some sort? It's like this creepy sci-fi feel of like he's like reconnecting to the mothership. But honestly, those analogies are really not that far off. He is giving himself injections. He is reconnecting to the mothership. The only sense in which the analogy doesn't apply, the sci-fi analogy, is that he's not doing these things because he's an alien or because he's a freak. The reason he's doing these things is precisely because he's normal. He's not doing this. He doesn't have the need to do this because he's Jesus. He has the need to do this because he's human. And it works the same way for us. We have the same need, and the need would be met in the exact same way, which is why he's always saying to his disciples, come away with me. He's trying to teach them to do it too. Come away with me and get your strength restored so that you have the energy. So that's the why. Those are the two reasons why time alone with God is not the enemy of productivity. It's actually the secret to productivity. And you say, well, okay, I'm a little bit confused now, because these seem like two different things. What are we talking about here? Are we talking about you get alone with God and just gaze upon his beauty just for its own sake, like you were talking about last night? Or are we talking about, this seems like another thing you're talking about now, you get alone with God to get wisdom and get strength for yourself. Just last night you were saying, beauty is about just for its own sake. But now this other thing you're talking about seems more utilitarian, seems more transactional, seems about, what benefit you're getting. So which is it? Those can't be the same thing. But they are the same thing. Those are the same thing. And the reason they're the same thing is because the only way you'll get the energy and the only way you'll get the strength is if you really do gaze on his beauty. That's where the transformation, personal transformation, happens. The first half of the Lord's Prayer, fully the first half of the prayer, there's no mention of us. It's all about God. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's all about God, the whole first half. All the stuff about give us our daily bread and help us with temptation, all of that, forgive us our sins, it doesn't come until the second half of the prayer. And the reason for that is because you have to focus on God first. That's when you're transformed. What Jesus is saying, essentially, when he teaches his disciples to pray like that, he says, before you ask for anything else, ask for me. Because the one thing you need is to stop thinking about your needs just for a few minutes and to focus on God instead. And if you do that, if you can focus on him, then the strength and the wisdom come. See, it's not bad to want those things. It's not bad to know that strength and wisdom are benefits of spending time alone with God. It's not bad for that to be part of the motivation for why you do it. But the trick is you just have to forget about those things for a few minutes. You have to put those things on the shelf and focus on God himself. And what will happen is at the exact moment that you do forget about them, you know, you're going to God because you need strength and energy. At the exact moment that you forget that you're going to God because you need strength and energy and you're just consumed with him, that's the moment when you get the strength and energy. But you have to forget about it first. You have to go indirectly. You have to seek these things indirectly. You can't just say, all right, God, I got 20 minutes, so give me some strength and give me some energy. That will never work. You can't throw up a 10-second prayer, you know, all right, give me some strength now. That's not a vending machine. You know, it's not like you just press the flavor and whatever you want rolls out. It doesn't work like that. You remember the phrase from Isaiah 40, and it was a phrase that was in the song we sang right before this, is those who wait upon the Lord. Those who wait upon the Lord. And that's not a unique phrase to Isaiah 40. Actually, it's one of the most often used phrases in the entire book of Psalms, the Bible's prayer book. My soul waits for the Lord. I wait for you over and over again, waiting on God. And what I love about that phrase is that it points an arrow to what the real obstacle is for us. Because the thing that New Yorkers hate having to do more than anything else is wait. And yet God says, if you want to see my glory, and you want to see my beauty, and you want to actually get this wisdom and this strength that's available, that's what you're going to have to do. So that's what we're going to do now. And what's, you know, normally I tell you to do something on Sunday mornings, and, you know, you might have forgotten even what it was by the time you get home. This morning, I have the extremely gratifying experience, because you are captives here, of telling you to do something and then making you do it right afterwards. So we're going to have this time, this hour set aside to just do exactly that, to wait upon God. And you say, well, okay, just one last question. I think I might have missed something, which is, how do I do that? You know, do I literally just sit there and stare at the wall and wait for an hour? Well, it's not bad. I mean, that's kind of like a more advanced technique. So we're trying to ease you into it. So what we have is we have 7 different activities that you can do during this time. I know it sounds like defeating the purpose, you know, activities, but this is active waiting. I'm trying to meet you halfway. So 3 of them are speaking things where you read aloud off a page. 2 of them are writing activities where you're writing in your notebook. And then 2 of them are just the kind of more along the lines of staring at the wall, or 2 different ways of just listening to God and being still before him. A couple of notes just practically, logistically on this. First, this is not linear. So it's not like you start at the beginning of the program and just plow your way through. There's way too much there for that. And the other thing is, on purpose, we actually kept this the exact same as last year. It's the same exact time of solitude as last year. The point of that is, so it forces you to do something different than you did last year if you came last year. So the way to approach it is you read the instructions in your notebook and you read all the activities, and then you kind of just, you know, gut intuitive, decide what you want to do first. And it's a menu of options. You don't go from the beginning to the end, but you just pick something out and start with that. And maybe you do one thing for the whole hour, or maybe, you know, that's not really working for you and try something else, and you spend a few minutes on a number of different things. Just a couple more practical tips, and then I'll let you go. The first is that you do actually have to be alone. It's not a group activity, so you know, don't do it with somebody. You know, don't sit right next to a friend or your spouse. In terms of where to go, so half of you can go back to your rooms. The other half of you, spouses or roommates, have to find somewhere else. So you can, you know, argue with your spouse or roommate about who's going to get the room. And then the other options are, you know, the hotel lobby, or it's not that cold today. You can sit outside. You can walk some of the activities, the non-writing ones. You can walk and do them. Or you can go to your car if you drove. So you got to find a spot to be alone. The enemies are going to be the biggest enemy by far is falling asleep. So if you drink, which by the way, going back to, you know, the thing about having enough energy, this proves my point. You have plenty of energy as long as you got this stimulus, but then as soon as you try to do something hard and something really worthwhile, all of a sudden, why are you so tired now? You know? So, if you drink coffee, drink a lot of coffee, this is not the time to break your drug addiction. do that some other time. You gotta stay awake. To say the obvious, do not lay down. You know, you don't do this on your bed. You know, so the enemy of sleep, and then the other enemy is going to be distractions. So that's why I recommended that you bring headphones and you know listen to something, white noise or nature sounds or Gregorian chants, even you know classical music. If it yourself whether that's distracting for you or not. Don't listen to, like, top 40 pop, you know, that's not going to work. And don't spend your whole time trying to find the right thing to listen to either. So maybe it's a good idea for you, maybe not, I don't know. So stay awake, try not to get distracted. And then what we'll do is when that's over, we're going to come back here and they'll have reset the room into circles. And we're going to kind of debrief the experience. So for some of you, you know, you're going to feel like, nothing happened. That was a complete waste of time. And you didn't necessarily do anything wrong. You know, don't beat yourself up about that. And so you should just say that. You should feel free to say that. For others of you, something very profound will happen. And so it's going to be really beneficial to hear from one another about those varied experiences. So the groups are going to be based on community groups. And then those of you who aren't in community groups, we put you in a group. And there's lists of which group you're in the back. We've also emailed you, or we will have emailed you a list of which group you're in. So let's see, what time is it now? 10:30. Okay, perfect. So 10:25. So you're back here at 11:30. So you got an hour and 5 minutes, and we'll come back here and debrief after the time of solitude. So let me pray for us before we go. God, as we prayed last night, as we sang this morning, we ask that you would speak to us. We ask that as we are still before you, you would take this time we're giving you of waiting upon you, and you would use it. You would use it in our lives. That we'd come to see you in a new way, to forget about ourselves for a minute. And then through that, we'd be transformed. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen.